From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The investigative journalist Mitchell Zukov knows people are suspicious of stories about the attack on the diplomatic compound in Benghazi, Libya in 2012. He knows the story usually comes through a filter of electoral politics. But he says his new book is not about what the U.S. government did after the attack, whether there was a cover-up or a conspiracy. Zukov is interested in what happened on the ground in Benghazi that night. In fact, he's narrowed the story down to 13 crucial hours. Today in the program, Zukov is joining us to tell that story from the perspective of the surviving American Security Force contractors, what they did and what they saw and what happened to them and those who died. Join us after the news. Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Tomorrow in Washington, a U.S. House committee begins its first open hearing looking into the terror attacks on the U.S. diplomatic outpost in Benghazi, Libya. This was September of 2012. Four Americans were killed that night, including the American ambassador to Libya, Christopher Stevens, and a State Department communications officer, Sean Smith. Two security operators were among those who died, Tyrone Woods and Glenn Doherty. The investigative journalist Mitchell Zukov has written a book about what happened that night. In fact, he focuses on 13 critical hours in that attack. Zukov also knows the story has become the centerpiece of an ongoing partisan controversy, so he sidesteps that part in the story and focuses on what happened on the ground and in the streets. The book is called 13 Hours. We spoke with Mitchell Zukov earlier today from a studio in Boston. He's a professor of journalism at Boston University, the author of a number of books, a few of which we've profiled on this program. I began the conversation by asking why he wanted to wade into a story so fraught with so much baggage.
It's a question I've asked myself a few times. But in all seriousness, it was because it was so political that I felt that it was important to tell this story, because all of these politics had nothing to do with the actual events in Benghazi. We knew all of this stuff, or we thought we knew, whether the allegations of what happened in Washington and somewhat what happened in Tripoli, but almost no one knew what happened on the ground in Benghazi. And so when I realized it would be possible to tell the story through the guys who were actually there, who fought this battle, as a journalist, I couldn't not tell it.
How are people reacting? I mean, these are early days for the book, I know, but I'm sure you expected some suspicion on the left anyway, and then probably those from the political right excited that someone was on their side. I mean, how are people reacting in that way?
I think there's an old parable about people look in the mirror and see what they want to see. Yeah. So there is some of that. But I've been enormously relieved, frankly, that both the New York Times and Fox News has seen this for what it is, which is an apolitical book, which is a story, which it's a work of journalism told through these people who are actually there. So the first day before the book even came out, the Times wrote a story about some of the revelations in the book, and Fox News the same day moved a piece on it. And so I feel as though there is skepticism on the left, and I understand it. And there is excitement on the right, and I understand that too. But from my perspective, very little of that has anything to do with the book. The book is the book, and it stands on its own as an apolitical narrative recounting of a moment in history.
I think, and this is how you put it in the book, the security operators, it seems like where you've sort of shifted the focus is away from the political dynamics to, as you say, the men who sort of fought this fight, the security operators who, as you say in the book, wanted their actions to be understood on their own terms.
Exactly. You know, these guys had spent now, 2 full years being told or hearing from others what happened there and what it means. And they were boiling about that. They felt that people didn't appreciate what happened. And, you know, they're focused on all four men, certainly, whose lives were lost. But they were frustrated that people were not talking about the 24 or 25 lives they saved. Mm. And they were not talking about Roan and Bub, the two fellow operators who didn't make it that night. They were talking about them as political, straw men, not as men, as individuals, as heroes. So that was difficult, and I felt part of my job was to restore that.
It's interesting. They, as you describe in the book, they returned home after all of this, returned to their lives, and for a long time they remained silent about all of that. What was it like convincing them to trust you and tell the story?
Well, they had decided even before they were talking with me that they wanted to tell the story. So it was much more a matter of getting them to trust me. Mm-hmm. I really like these guys a lot, but we're very different. I'm a university professor in Boston, and these guys are, former Navy SEAL and former Army Rangers. And, we've lived different lives. And yet, I think they trusted me when we first started talking about doing this. Because I wasn't trying to sell them anything. They appreciated that I said, if I do this, I'm not going to try and convince you to do it with me. I'm telling you, if we do this, this is how I'm going to approach it. There have been so many half-truths. There have been so many lies that anything I can't verify, journalism is a discipline of verification. And if I can't know that it's true or as true as we can make it, then we're not putting it in the book. And they appreciated that, and I think that sort of won them over when we first started talking and then got together, that, hey, this guy is not trying to score any points or carry anybody's water, and they liked that.
Some wanted their names, were willing to have you use their real name. Some weren't. I guess that there was a little bit of negotiating that you had to do in that regard, I suppose.
There was. One who at first was not going to use his name, who's known in the book as Tig, John Tigan, decided at the end he did want to tell his story. He did, he saw the draft of the book, and we were using a false name for him, a pseudonym, and he realized, no, I'm proud of this. I'm proud of what I did that night, and I want to be out there. I have complete respect for the two guys who decided not to. There are complicated reasons in both cases that I can't go into. Yeah. That. Factored into their decisions.
Well, we should say that one of the critical players, and we'll get to this story, one of the critical players is only known as Bob, the CIA
Yes.
And ex-chief. Again, we'll talk about Bob later, but that seems a pretty delicate kind of story mm-hmm. to tell, especially given what kind of responsibility he may have had in the outcome
Yes.
of that story.
And that's something I spent a lot of time thinking about. But it really comes down to, a fairly simple decision. Bob comes in for criticism in the book, certainly. And I think his actions that night are a real takeaway from this story, and we can talk about those. But ultimately, no responsible journalist, I can't imagine any responsible person, considering identifying a career CIA intelligence chief publicly without his permission,
right.
that could, potentially put him in serious danger.
So let's back up. I want to ask you about a story you mentioned at the beginning of the book, of this struggle to defend a diplomatic post in Benghazi. And it gets out of hand. The envoys and the staffers make this desperate plea for help. They're worried they'll be shot or that they'll suffocate from smoke inhalation because the attackers, of course, have started these fires. But, of course, this all took place 47 years ago. It's really uncanny, the similarities. What do you make of that?
Yeah. When I learned about what happened in 1967, I knew almost immediately that was the prologue. Mm-hmm. That had to be the prologue of the book. It's a cliche, history repeating itself, right? Where you have this small group of Americans who are besieged in a diplomatic post, and it just it was just incredible to me. And then when I was able to find John Corman's memoir, he was the chief American officer at the time in Benghazi in 67, when there was, again, a mistaken, and the other parallels were a question of mistaken understandings of what was going on. Apparently, the Libyans and the Egyptians who happened to be there had heard false radio reports that American warplanes had provided cover for Israel in the beginning of the war with Egypt in June of 67. And that enraged them, and suddenly they set upon this outpost. So it was a perfect contrast in a way, because the difference then was, and where that prologue ends, is fortunately for the Americans in 67, they were able to get help from a British battalion that was stationed just outside Libya, outside Benghazi under a treaty agreement. But there was no such force available this time. And so it allowed me to shift the focus on to these guys, these civilian contractors, these remarkable, I struggle for words because they're really incredible men, and that this small band of six guys, were all that stood between the Americans in Benghazi and death.
One thing you do in the book is put this very particular moment, these distilled 13 hours, into a larger historical context early on in the book. And you say the history of Libya is, this is how you describe it, as an inventory of invasions by outside powers. I mean, you've got the Phoenicians and the Persians and the Romans and the Byzantines and the Ottomans and list after list, and that which is not to mention the sort of modern-day situation, the Italians, of course. Mm-hmm. So describe that a little bit, because it seems like the sort of point is that Benghazi became kind of a punching bag during World War II, and a target of these constant bombings as these various sides traded for control. I mean, they were being bombed constantly during the war, World War II.
Absolutely. And Eastern Libya, Benghazi is the center of Eastern Libya in particular. That I think I may have said in the book, if you had a fleet and an army, Benghazi was on your to-do list.
Right.
And that has remained this... that's so part of the culture. If you look in Benghazi, you see the architecture reflects the various people and the various peoples who've controlled it, who've conquered it over the centuries or the millennia, and that's baked into the culture, and that's baked into the people there. I think there's a fierceness of the beaten dog to some extent, and I'm not in any way comparing them to dogs, but that idea of always in a little bit of a defensive crouch, who is this person coming onto our land? What's going to happen next? I think is the history of Benghazi.
And of course, the region didn't fare much better once Muammar Gaddafi takes control. There's a remarkable story of how Gaddafi not only neglects the region, marginalizes it. Eastern Libya, that is. He even targets their soccer club,
and that's where they will not stand.
Right.
It's a bit of a soccer revolution where he puts his son becomes in charge of a competing soccer team, and soccer is huge in Libya, and he raids the main club in Benghazi for its best players, and then Gaddafi, being Gaddafi, or his son being a Gaddafi, bribes the referees, and the referees understand that you make calls a certain way when the People's Club of Benghazi is playing the People's Club of Tripoli,
right,
which is the Gaddafi team. And it becomes one humiliation too many when they're about to lose their standing in the top rung of soccer teams in the country. And there's an uprising. And it doesn't last very long, and but it lingers, and this anger between Benghazi and Tripoli ends up being a big part of Gaddafi's downfall, because the revolution is launched from Benghazi, and nobody there has forgotten the soccer rivalry.
Mm-hmm. You describe Benghazi as going back to that reference to. An animal, a long-abused animal. Again, not that Libyans are animals, but mean and wary. That's the context, I think, really, that you have to understand, I suppose, to understand this story.
Yeah, I think so. This is an area where much of the oil wealth in Libya is in the eastern portion of the country, and yet Gaddafi, drained it almost literally, and built up Tripoli into a much more cosmopolitan city. And so they felt, even within Libya, they felt neglected and abused. And so, again, that gets into the psyche of a people. And over the years, they were tired, I think, of being controlled by outsiders.
Did the Americans understand that point, do you think? Was that taken into account, that context? Because it seems it should have been part of the intelligence assessment that this is a long-suffering region that is unstable, could retaliate at any moment. I mean, did the Americans understand that, do you think?
If they understood it, I'm not sure they fully appreciated it and what it would mean on the ground. I think the evidence of that is the security posture at the diplomatic compound there. You have, frankly, a very soft target. Now, I think Ambassador Chris Stevens understood it better than most. He did request extra military officers to remain in Libya with him in Tripoli earlier in the summer, and that request was denied by his superiors at the State Department. And so even if he did appreciate it, he didn't fully act on it because he did go to Benghazi on this visit, coinciding with September 11th. And so if you think about that, it's very public that an ambassador is in residence on a temporary basis. It's September 11th. The compound is incredibly vulnerable. So I think it's very fair to say that it was not appreciated.
Mitchell Zukov, his book is called 13 Hours, the inside account of what really happened in Benghazi. We'll take a quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're broadcasting our conversation with investigative journalist Mitchell Zukov. We spoke with him earlier this morning from Boston about the terrorist attacks on the U.S. diplomatic compound in Benghazi in 2012. Zukov says the story has become so bound up in political hearsay that what really happened has fallen by the wayside. He's written a new book that breaks down the crucial 13 hours of this story. It's called 13 Hours. Explain what the Global Response Staff is. This is another important bit of background that we have to understand the story. This is a government organization that was created after the 9/11 attacks.
Exactly. And, you know, wherever we have diplomats, it's pretty fair guess, not far away, we also have CIA case officers. Mm-hmm. We have intelligence folks, looking after our concerns in that way. And our old-fashioned or our movie image of CIA case officers or agents as Jason Bourne or 007 types, that's just simply not the case. Yeah. More likely they're going to be valedictorians from an Ivy League school or language experts. Mm-hmm. And so it was understood that these folks were operating in incredibly dangerous places. So the GRS was created of contract officers, usually former military, former Army Rangers, former Navy SEALs, former special operations folks, usually men, who would provide security for these case officers as they went around gathering intelligence.
It seems like there's and this seems crucial to what eventually happens, it seems like there's a cultural conflict of sorts going on. You have full-time CIA staffers on one hand. They have a series of protocols, a way of sort of perceiving the world, of perceiving threats, those kinds of things. And then you have a more kind of on-the-ground kind of perspective that comes from those former military special operators. They have a military perspective, and it seems like there's a conflict between those cultures. Is that fair to say?
Certainly there was in Benghazi. From what the guys have told me, each station is somewhat different, how much they're appreciated or how they're treated. But very much so in Benghazi, there was this base chief, this fellow we talked about, Bob, mm-hmm. who the guys felt very much as though he treated them like Walmart security guards, did not appreciate what they knew, what they were capable of. I don't know. I can't say, you know, if it was ego or pride or just, you know, he was an older, he was a veteran officer. If he was harking back to the days when CIA agents were a little bit more Jason Bourne.
Mm-hmm. The men who are in this contingent, the former soldiers, basically, not active duty soldiers. Their life as soldiers had come to an end. It was coming to an end. They were doing insurance adjusting and real estate and private investigation. Tyrone Woods, mm-hmm. was a medic and a nurse as well. But they were all on this duty as part of their private security work. I mean, it's an interesting position to be in. On one hand, they have it in their blood to be soldiers, but on the other hand, they're also living this other kind of life. Talk about that part of this story. Former soldiers, but still very much active, at least in that role.
Exactly. It's this kind of twilight zone of being a warrior and also a dad and a mortgage holder.
Yeah.
But that's very much, and this has become very common in our country these days. There are tens of thousands of these contract private security officers working around the globe on contract basis for 3 months or longer, and it's lucrative. And these guys have these special skills that are very valuable to the government. But at the same time, they're at night, they're Skyping with in all these cases, they were all married, their mm-hmm. wives and children. And so they're soldiers and yet not soldiers, but in their hearts, I think I can say all these guys very much see themselves as soldiers, whether they're active duty or not.
Yeah. Well, you say the challenge is there's the yin and there's the yang. I mean, for these men, it was a chance to return to this job that they loved and this camaraderie and a really defined sense of purpose. But we should say, and this is important because you explore this in the book, the money was also pretty good.
Yeah. A couple months on, a couple months off over the course of a year, these guys could make north of $150,000 a year. And a lot of them live in fairly rural places. And so that's a salary that's hard to replace as a former soldier, maybe working as a deputy police chief in Colorado or somewhere. And yet, as you say, you know, Doug, there is this yin and yang. And the operator, the former Navy SEAL, we call Jack Silva, mm-hmm. articulated it really well for me. And I used him, if you will, in the book to talk about this, that he was often throughout that night thinking about his wife and children, thinking about the danger, and resolving that, it doesn't look like I'm ever going to see them again. And it's a very nice salary for these guys, but it comes at a price.
Let's talk about the sentiment towards Americans on the ground there in Benghazi. Because you say at first the Benghazians expressed thanks to the Americans for helping to get rid of Gaddafi in the so-called revolution. But it didn't take long for that to wear off.
Exactly. How long were they going to be thankful for, I guess, was the feeling, especially with Islamic extremist militias on the rise, filling the vacuum where there was no government. So, yes, in the early months after the revolution, Americans reported, and there was a really revealing New York Times story about this, Americans couldn't pay for a coffee at a cafe. Cab drivers weren't taking their fares. But that started easing off. And the guys did talk to me about there were a lot of people they still met who were very friendly personally. But these Islamic militias that were fighting for power identified themselves either directly or at least philosophically with al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. And so that automatically meant that the Americans were no longer our friends.
The role of local militias is another really critical part to this story. Help us understand that part a little bit more. These local militias, you say, they really shifted from being, you know, revolutionary fighters to being national guardsmen, basically. Some were sort of friendly, some were outright enemies, of course, but it seemed as though some had, some were sort of, as you say, outwardly grateful to the U.S.,
So who could you trust, I guess, is the question.
Boy, that is the right question. And that's the question that the men on the ground asked themselves every day.
Yeah.
And their conclusion was no one too much.
Right.
Even this one military, this one militia, the 17 February Martyrs Brigade, which had some relations with the Americans on the ground, the contractors, the GRS staffers, held them very much at arm's length. They never felt completely comfortable with the 17 February guys because it was still an Islamic militia. And despite some, you know, good relations with them, there were tensions as well. There were tensions over how much they were being paid by the Americans to help guard and be a quick response force for the diplomatic compound. So I think a posture of wariness was exactly the correct one, and yet I don't think Bob appreciated that fully, and I'm not sure the folks at the diplomatic compound, either the diplomatic security folks or Ambassador Stevens, fully appreciated that.
Well, you point out these militias had, in fact, some of them anyway, fought against the American troops in Iraq. I mean, highly motivated to kill Americans. They could be.
Yes. And now suddenly, you know, guns, actually weapons, were very controlled under Gaddafi. But in his absence, suddenly these storehouses, these armories, were thrown open. And so these former jihadis now suddenly have access to weapons, a vacuum of power, and some Americans in their midst. It's not a good recipe.
I guess there's an important question here. Is Benghazi really any different than any other diplomatic outpost in the Middle East? I mean, couldn't it be said that most of these are characterized with the same kinds of dynamics as Benghazi, which is to say fragile alliances with militias and groups with questionable loyalties? What makes Benghazi different, do you think?
I think that's true to an extent. But I think what distinguished Benghazi at this moment was the absence of a host government. Normally, when we send diplomats anywhere in the world, even the most dangerous places, there is some kind of functioning government that controls some kind of army that will respond if there's danger to any diplomats in the region. In Benghazi, because there was no functioning government, really, you know, this security council was ineffectual at best. You had these competing heavily armed militias that could go after each other at any moment. And the British recognized this. When the British ambassador was attacked, when the British envoy was attacked in June in his convoy, the British said, wait a second, we can't be there. They pulled up stakes. They said, this is not a place where we can either have enough protection of our own or trust the host government because there is none. That's what distinguished Benghazi. Now, certainly, there are other places around the globe where we send people enormously dangerous, but we have this trust that there will be a reciprocity. We will protect them when they're on our in our national boundaries, on their soil, in our country, and vice versa. They couldn't count on that in Benghazi.
I want to come back to something you mentioned earlier, and that was this awareness, certainly by Ambassador Stevens, that it was getting more and more dangerous, or seemed to be more and more dangerous. What did the United States know about that situation? Stevens sends a cable suggesting that Islamic extremism was growing. He said the situation was, quote, unpredictable, volatile, and violent. But he gets turned down for more security, more bodyguards. Why?
That's a great question. I'm not sure we've gotten an adequate answer for that. That the State Department said they were under the impression that the diplomatic security staff could handle it adequately. It wasn't a matter of money because that was out of the Department of Defense budget. That was a site security team of military folks. And so I think that has never made sense. And I think that was something that, frankly, the Accountability Review Board, the State Department's own review, targeted, that was not adequate. It didn't make sense for them to deny Ambassador Stevens' request there.
And we don't need to spend much time, you know, adjudicating this matter, but Hillary Clinton has said, as you point out in the book, the U.S. to the idea that the U.S. hadn't provided enough support. She's called that misinformation, even flat out deceit. So there's that counter view, of course, out there, I suppose.
There is. And I think you know, there were people who have made really unfair and scurrilous charges, completely unfounded, about, you know, accusing the secretary of somehow purposely wanting this to happen or deny or personally denying it. And there's no evidence of that. So I think what she's saying absolutely has merit. And yet the State Department did deny this security team, and to the point where the General Hamm from the African Command personally went again to Ambassador Stevens and offered it yet again. And because his superiors at State had denied it, Ambassador Stevens declined this offer. But there's no question that there was less security than Ambassador Stevens wanted.
Mitchell Zukov, his book is called 13 Hours, the inside account of what really happened in Benghazi. We'll take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the investigative journalist Mitchell Zukov. We're talking about his book called 13 Hours, the inside account of what really happened in Benghazi. We spoke with Mitchell Zukov earlier this morning from a studio in Boston.
Well, I want to get us to September 11th of 2012. Let's get the setting right here. It's a compound, the CIA Benghazi Annex. It was supposed to be a secret location, supposed to be the secretive place, but as you make it clear in the book, it wasn't much of a secret really around there.
It's hard to keep secret a place in Benghazi where Americans are driving in and out of a walled compound on a regular basis. It wouldn't be hard for people to know that there was, whether they knew it was CIA or not, they knew there were Americans there. And it's only, you know, it's 3/4 of a mile from the diplomatic compound, yeah, this larger compound where the ambassador was. And so they're not exactly co-located, as they call it, but they're awfully close.
Right. But far enough away for that to be an issue, as we'll learn, of course. Let's talk about the day. It begins, you point out in the book, it was pretty quiet. Didn't seem to be much really going on, even though it was, I mean, everyone knew what the day was. It was, of course, the anniversary of 9/11.
It was, but there was one ominous note that morning. Just after dawn, a Libyan police car pulls up outside the diplomatic compound, and a man wearing a Libyan police uniform climbs to the second floor of a building under construction directly across from the compound, and using a cell phone, begins photographing or videoing inside the compound. There are one of two words for that. That's either surveillance, or that is even worse, that is reconnaissance, planning some kind of action. And he is confronted by one of the unarmed guards who are hired under a contract by the Americans, and he leaves. And but there's enough concern about this that Ambassador Stevens and his staff are drafting a firmly worded complaint to the Libyan police force, but tragically that of course never gets sent. There isn't time enough. Mm. But that note sets off kind of a little bit of a frisson of fear, I think, among the Americans, or concern. And it was already planned that the ambassador would spend the entire day inside the compound, just to not tempt fate on September 11th. And so he does, and he visits with a number of other envoys, local politicians, and goes about the business of his day. But as you said, yes, it is a quiet day in Benghazi, unlike what's happening in Cairo, where there are protests, students storming the American embassy. There are no protests in Benghazi. It's quiet enough for 7:30 that night for Ambassador Stevens to walk his last guest outside the compound walls into the gravel street outside to say goodnight. Mm. He certainly couldn't have done that had there been protesters.
Of course. 9:30, he's back in the villa. And it's interesting as he's reflecting on this, happy to be back in Benghazi, Ambassador Stevens.
Yes. He's writing this in his diary saying he likes this particular compound, the warm, the moist air coming off the Mediterranean. He likes the people. And yet, again, as he writes, but the last thing he writes in his diary, never-ending security concerns and an ellipsis, dot, 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 trailing off.
That's around 9:30. Moments later, really, literally minutes later, someone sees men rushing through the gates.
Yes.
And the guards, as you describe in the book, have kind of melted away.
Exactly. The Libyans who are supposed to be watching the gate and as the contractors say, at least be a speed bump, they hope, set off an alarm, provide some resistance, provide none, and set off no alarm. It just so happens, there are five diplomatic security agents on the compound with Ambassador Stevens and a communications expert, Sean Smith. And it just so happens by coincidence that one of them, Alec Henderson, happens to be working that night doing paperwork in the command center. And he's not on duty, but he just wanted to take care of some things. He hears a noise, and he looks up and sees on the video monitor this sort of checkerboard of feeds from multiple cameras. And one of them points to the front front driveway. And he looks up, and he sees 16 to 20 men in that first moment rushing onto the property with AK-47s, with two of them carrying banners, one white, one black, with Arabic writing, and firing off their weapons. And so he hits the duck and cover alarm to alert everyone else. And they are caught completely unawares, tragically. The other four diplomatic security agents, three of them are sitting around the pool at the main villa talking. One is inside the villa watching television. And Sean Smith and Ambassador Stevens are in their bedrooms. So almost immediately, they are dispersed. They end up within a minute or two in three different buildings. One who's in charge of the ambassador, Scott Wickland, gets the ambassador and Sean Smith into the locked safe haven inside the villa, this little wing that is cordoned off. Mm-hmm. But they're not really safe there.
How safe is that room? I mean, we tragically know what happens, but was it well designed? Was it just? I think the contrast between the CIA annex, yes, fully stocked with weapons and fully seemed to be prepared. If you put that in contrast with what was going on in the diplomatic compound, it's pretty stark.
Absolutely, Doug. Anytime somebody said, well, was the diplomatic compound really that bad? I say, just look 3/4 of a mile away. Yeah. Exactly. You have rooftop fighting positions. You have pre-staged ammunition. You have towers at the corners of the property to shoot over the walls if somebody's coming at you. You have lights that are aiming outside into the darkened areas around it to see who's coming at you. So the idea that this supposedly secret facility is a hardened facility, and the public face of America in Benghazi is a soft target without, in this case, to the point we're talking about, without fire suppressants, without any kind of long ability to withstand a siege is stark.
There's a crucial moment that plays out here now, and I want you to walk us through this. Of course, those in the diplomatic compound contact the CIA annex, and they say, basically, we've been hit. Now, what happens next, this seems to be Mitzukov, the most crucial part of this. There's this 20-minute, and I want you to walk us through this, where the stakes for this story really play out.
Sure. Almost immediately when Alec Henderson sees those people running onto the compound, he does call over to the compound, to the annex. And the call goes out to the GRS operators, the guys who helped me to tell this story in 13 hours. You guys, everybody come to the main building. And they hustle over there. They find out what's happening. And within a couple of minutes, they are, in their parlance, jocked up. They put on their armor. They grab their long guns, their night vision goggles, and their helmets. And they stage themselves in two armored vehicles ready to go.
Yeah.
And they know that the only thing you can do in this situation, every ounce of their energy, everything they've learned as military experts, collectively 100 years of military experience, is we have to get over there before they gain the initiative, as they call it, before they seize the day. And then they're that much harder to fight back. And they are told by their commanding officer, the base chief, who is not a military officer but an intelligence officer, wait. And told it again, wait.
Now, this is the Bob we were talking about.
This is Bob.
Yep.
Exactly. And they're hearing radio. They're on the same frequencies as the guys in the compound. And they keep hearing things. They're setting the buildings on fire. We're taking fire. And they are, you know, they know that not only is the danger greater for the seven men at the diplomatic compound, but every passing minute, the danger is going to be greater for them, because they're going to be going into a situation where their enemy's perimeter defenses may be set up, and they're going to be expecting them at some point. Ostensibly, Bob was, as it's been explained since, was trying to coordinate a response to rally help from the 17 February militia we spoke about earlier.
Right.
Which had promised to be a quick reaction force. Now, I have to take a quick digression here. This has never made sense to me, because remember, at this particular moment, the 17 February Martyrs Brigade was on a work stoppage against the Americans. They had refused to accompany Ambassador Stevens as he moved throughout Benghazi. They were not going to protect him as he did that, because it was a dispute over pay. Their loyalties were already suspect. They're in a contract dispute over how much we're paying them, and yet we're going to rely on them, or we're going to rally them to be our active response to a military incursion onto our diplomatic compound. The guys, again, based on their military experience, they find that just extraordinary and ridiculous. And yet that was what was apparently happening. And Bob was in contact with Tripoli, and there was an open line to Washington.
So what's he doing? Is Bob saying essentially, look, let's at least give them a chance to help us here. If we're going to have an alliance at moments like this, we've got to see if we can trust them. Whether or not that was wise, I guess you kind of understand where he was coming from?
Apparently. And yet... I don't know if that was the entirety of his motivation.
Right.
Remember, he's a career CIA guy.
Yeah.
He does not want to reveal the location of the CIA base. So once
even
you set
it was
these
known,
guys
pretty
out,
much pretty rough.
Even though it was known, but you know, old habits die hard.
Sure.
And there may be other things. And as I say in the book, I tried extensively to speak directly with Bob, and it was not to be.
Right.
So I don't pretend to know what was going on in his mind, but it's also worth noting that a couple of months before, one of the heroes, I think, of this story, Tyrone Roan Woods, was held up at gunpoint with another operator on the way back from getting a load of materials from the airport. And again, at that point, Bob said, told the guys to wait, who wanted to go help Roan, and... he said, well, we'll get the 17 February militia to respond to it. They never responded. And Roan was held at gunpoint. Fortunately, he was able to talk and maybe bluff his way out of it. But the writing was on the wall that 17 February could not be trusted at that moment. And yet that caused this 20-plus minute delay until the guys heard a radio call. If you don't get here, we're going to die. And at that moment, they are sitting in these two armored vehicles, and Roan looks back to Tonto, who's driving the other vehicle, and it's understood. It's time to go.
Were they disobeying orders technically at that moment?
Very much so. They were breaking command.
What happens when they get there? When they arrive, things have collapsed, burning buildings, noxious smoke everywhere. They're having to really fight their way in to protect the people there as well.
Very much so. They can't get all the way to the compound because the time has passed and the initiative has been seized. The objective has been seized by the enemy. And so they have to break off on foot into two groups, one group going around to the, toward the back gate, and these three guys led by Roan, Jack, and Tig, going toward the front gate. And Tig first has to clear the road by launching three grenades to hopefully scare off the folks right outside the gate. And then they reach the gate, and this is just one of those amazing moments that I get chills every time I think about it. Roan is in front, and he hears Tig call back to the annex, "We're going in." And Roan takes that as a signal and pops up from behind this concrete barrier and wheels around and runs through this front gate of this compound. It's dark. He has no idea how many people are in there and whether the second he walks through that gate or runs through that gate, he's going to be shot. The buildings are on fire, but he does it, and he goes in because he has an objective, and that's to help the seven Americans who are trapped inside. And of course, Jack and Tig follow him in and cover him as he reaches the villa to begin the search for the ambassador.
Well, we know what happens, and I'm hoping people will read the book to sort of see how this all plays out. Since we're running out of time, though, what do you think are the crucial questions? Did they get to this idea of what we understood and what we didn't, and why didn't we understand what was going on? Why didn't we know the circumstances on the ground? I mean, what do you think are the crucial questions here? If you take all the political baggage, all the partisan stuff away, what are the questions that rise to the top for you?
Well, the initial question was always, and I think remains for everyone, could this have been prevented? And I think the answer is unequivocally yes. And whether it's fully understood and been fully implemented around the world, I think we're going to find that out, I hope. You know, we're just beginning hearings from the House Select Committee on Benghazi, and I was very pleased to hear that their first order of business is not political at all. It's have the security changes recommended over the past 2 years been implemented by the State Department at facilities around the world? Because the key question was why did we allow an ambassador to be in such a vulnerable situation? Why were requests for additional security denied? Why, despite all the lessons we've learned over the past 30 years from the bombing in Beirut and the bombing of other American diplomatic targets around the world, why were there facilities that, because they didn't rise to the technical level of a consulate, why were they allowed to be to fall short of the required security measures? And so I think we're going to get those answers, and I think we're getting those answers. But I think what I'd like to think that we've demonstrated here is that there can never be a question whether it was preventable. It was then even, I believe, preventable again after the attack began. I the guys are convinced, and I think if you look at the timeline closely and as we lay it out in the book, as the minutes are ticking by, we're talking about a situation where those are the moments where the fires are being set. And had they been in a military situation, I find it hard to imagine that they would not have been allowed to go immediately. But because this unusual chain of command where you had an intelligence chief basically running a military situation that he was not equipped for, we ended up with the results that we did.
Let me ask you about that next day, September 12th, 2012. Mm-hmm. The surviving Americans, as you write, are making final preparations to leave the annex. And there's this argument that breaks out between Bob, the annex chief that we've talked about, CIA man, and the Benghazi GRS team leader. And it seems really dramatic. I wanted you to take us through that story, if you would.
It's time to go, finally. They've now lost Roan and Bub. They've been hit by mortars. The rest have somehow survived. and everyone is loading into the cars and the vehicles to take them to the airport. And Bob announces that he's not leaving. And to me, and again, I don't want to speculate, but it seems very clear, this is an intelligence officer. And he understands at this moment there has been an intelligence failure. There is no question that it was not understood what these militias were planning and what they were capable of as directed toward the Americans. And those answers needed to be found. Where did we go wrong? What did we not know? Who was responsible here? And he insists that he is going to stay. And at that moment, the GRS team leader tells him, you are relieved of duty. You are not in charge anymore. Effectively, the American presence in Benghazi, both diplomatically and from an intelligence standpoint, has ceased to exist. And this is now a military and a security operation. And it's my job to keep you from killing yourself.
One final image, which really struck me powerfully. Jack Silva, not his real name, but we come to know him fairly well in the book, of course. He's one of these security operators that you relied on for this story. He sees what you describe as this one-man honor guard on their way out. It's a gardener.
Yes. Throughout the night, Jack is up on this building, looking down, looking over, waiting for the next round of attacks to hit the annex. And every once in a while through the night, he's caught sight of this gardener going outside of this little shack where he lives on the property to pray and to smoke a cigarette. And the last sight, as Jack is now in a vehicle with another operator, and it's a flatbed truck, and there are bodies wrapped up on the back of the flatbed. And Jack catches out of the corner of his eye this gardener waving them goodbye as they leave.
Mitchell Zukov, his book is called 13 Hours, The Inside Account of What Really Happened in Benghazi. Mitchell Zukov, thank you very much for that time. I really appreciate you making time for
us. Thank you, Doug. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Taylor Almond. The show produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.